Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your Aftershock Monday episode for the week. And today I was lucky enough to be joined by Marguerite Bennett. Marguerite's been on the show before. Last time she was on, she talked about her insect series from Aftershock. And today, when I had her on, we got a chance to chat about Animosity, which is probably the biggest breakout hit from Aftershock Publishing. So it's always a treat to talk to Marguerite. And I feel like her series fits in perfectly with what Aftershock's doing, and it shows exactly the quality of story that Aftershock is all about, and it shows what's possible, and that the powers that be, the creative minds behind Aftershock, really know when they've got something special on their hands. With writers like Donnie Cates, Marguerite Bennett, Ryan Parrott, it's very evident that the quality and the really intriguing and compelling stories are going to continue with Aftershock. So I hope you guys all enjoy the interview. Thanks for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, everybody. I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the show writer Marguerite Bennett. Marguerite, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Like, I really enjoyed our conversation last time, so it's really a sincere pleasure to be back on.
Yeah, and it's always great to see you. So listeners, you won't know this, but Marguerite's pretty active on the convention circuit, and we see each other all the time. And mm-hmm. But this is one of those times you get to be privy to our conversation. So so welcome in, everyone.
And thank you for listening.
Definitely. Thanks for listening. So give everyone a quick reminder, Marguerite. Maybe this is the first time they're joining. They haven't didn't get to listen when you were on last time. Remind everybody kind of who you are, what you do, and maybe where they've seen your name before.
Sure. Well, I'm Marguerite Bennett, and I'm mostly a comic book writer. And you might know me from my work on DC Bombshells or Batwoman, or over at Marvel, I did the Angela series with Kieran Gillen and Angela Queen of Hell, and Years of Future Past and A-Force with G. Willow Wilson. And I've done some runs on Sheena Queen of the Jungle and Red Sonja for Dynamite. And I'm currently on Power Rangers for Boom Studios. And my two creator-owned series, Insects, through Aftershock Comics, and Animosity, also through the same publisher.
Yeah, and if any of you are curious about Insects, last time we had Marguerite on, that's what we talked about. So I encourage you to go check that out. It's a very beautiful love story, and not at all what you might expect. So. But today we're here to talk about Animosity. So why don't you remind our listeners what's kind of the elevator pitch? What's Animosity all about?
Yeah, absolutely. So my 60-second pitch is that Animosity is this black comedy apocalypse coming of age road trip story, where one day all of the animals sort of come online. They start thinking and they start talking. And in a lot of cases, they start taking revenge. You know, you have cows rebelling in their slaughterhouses. You have hens murdering the shit out of their rooster. You have the orca at SeaWorld rising up out of his tank, you know, all jaws and foam, and his towering trainer screaming. And he slams down his slippers and he goes, "Jessica, I can't deny my feelings for you any longer." And so it's just this ridiculous, over-the-top premise, and it was against this, like, this sort of absurd joke that's gone too far backdrop. You have this girl and her dog in New York City, and she's had him. He's a purebred bloodhound. She's had him since he was a little puppy, and she was his mom, and he was the baby. And, you know, she took care of him. She protected him. He raised him. He was the rental litter. But it's been several years since she adopted him. And, you know, it's come on the day of the wake is what they call this big event. And as a purebred, you know, he's pretty far through his life expectancy when this event occurs. And so when he comes online, he's the adult now and she's the child. And her parents are out of the picture pretty quickly in all the chaos. And so now he is facing the end of his life and also has the responsibility. Like, you know, he adores this girl. This girl is bigger than God, bigger than the universe and all creation as far as he is concerned. And he has to get her across country from New York City all the way to San Francisco, where her estranged half-brother lives. And she's the thing that gives his life meaning, but now the whole momentum of what's left of his life is to give that meaning up, is to give her away and make sure that she is safe and protected and has a future that he knows he won't live to see. And so against, you know, like the absurd absurdity and the comedy and the darkness and discomfort of, you know, this over the top story, you have a very sincere through line that begins us on our great American road trip.
Now, how long did you have this idea? You know, like, how did you come up with it? How long did you have it before you finally were able to realize the story at Aftershock?
You know, it was really kind of incidental. Like, you know, I'd had this sort of scraps and bits and pieces of this girl talking to her hound dog while they were hunting in the woods. And that's an old story. Like, I've been batting that around since I was a little kid. But it didn't actually become anything until, God, I want to say early 2016 or late 2015. Like, we all went out for dinner, me and the Aftershock guys. And I was there to pitch them a completely different story. I was there to pitch them on the Southern Gothic. And they were like, okay, well, that's interesting. Do you have anything else? And I just sort of tossed out this idea, you know, with like, when do the animals come online? They start thinking, they start talking, they start taking revenge. And, you know, told them about the girl and her dog and like pitched them like this three arc story. And they were like, I wasn't through the first arc before they were looking to their over the table. I'm like, yes, this is what we want. And I've never had a pitch greenlit so fast in my life. They were so supportive. But, you know, in terms of like where it came from, like that's a question I've been sort of stumped by for a long time. And because at first I thought, well, it's just like, it came from this scrap. Like it's been, you know, it's just one of those repeating images that you have in your life and didn't really interrogate it. But it wasn't until, probably just earlier this year, that like I was talking to my mama and I realized where the story came from after she hung up. And so, not to be hyperbolic, but my mother's a saint. And she, like, when we were even little kids, like we did not have like the golden retriever white picket fence childhood. Like, you know, we lived in an apartment and my mother loved dogs. And so she would go to the SPCA and ask them for their unadoptable dog. And like, you know, the dog that has behavior issues, the dog that's been abused, the dog that has health problems, the dog that has hospice it needs. And those were the dogs that filled my childhood. Those were the dogs that my mother brought home. And she worked with them and she loved them and she took care of them. I mean, like, you know, like the ones that people brought back. And, you know, and for the hospice care dogs, like she called it giving them a soft landing. And it was just like those over and over, like those are the dogs, like these fucked up hound dogs that made up my childhood. Like, you know, I was born in Richmond, Virginia. And the surrounding counties are all big hunting areas. And so people breed these hound dogs so irresponsibly and then just dump them at the end of the season. And so these dogs have never been socialized. They have all these health issues. You know, they haven't been vaccinated, like they haven't been taken care of. And they don't know what to do without the pack. And so, like, you know, their interaction with human beings, you know, even people trying to love them and trying to take care of them is so complex and so inherently damaged. And so, like, you know, there has been, you know, even since early childhood, this idea of parenthood being sort of wrapped up and conflated and entangled with messed up hound dogs and trying to make a family out of something with so much damage in it. And so I realized, you know, sort of in the course of Animosity, you know, it is that change, is that, you know, Jessie, little girl, starts out as the caretaker to Sandor, and then in the fullness of time, their roles are reversed, and he becomes the adult, and, you know, she's the child, and that it sort of parallels, what really does, it parallels the relationship that if you are lucky, you will one day have with your parents, you know, where you begin as the child, they are the adult, and if you live long enough, and if the love is there, then you become the parents to your parents as they enter second childhood. And so it's that shift in power and responsibility and love, but the love is still the driving thing throughout all of it. And that's what the story
is. Yeah, and what I find so interesting is, so that's kind of our way in. That's how we can relate to it. You know, a lot of us have pets or we grew up, you know, with beloved pets. But the other thing you're doing is you're exploring this huge idea of you know, just quintillions of beings coming into their own, coming online. Yeah. You're exploring that through some, because that idea is so big, it just blows all our minds, right? But you're exploring that through something that we can all relate to, right? The story of a girl and her dog.
Cheers. Yeah, no, it's apocalypse by overpopulation. but not in a way that you know we've seen before with humans.
Now, when you set out to tell the story, did you realize it was going to resonate with so many people, and not just comic readers? But this is one of those books that I hear so many people are discovering comics through, or they're discovering the story and falling in love with it, and they've never read a comic. I couldn't possibly have imagined that.
I pitched it to Aftershock as it was going to be like a 12-issue miniseries, and then maybe we would have another, like a 6-issue arc, and then another 6-issue arc, and that was done. And we're fun. Like, I'm working on issue 21 right now. And so it's just, you know, it's just bonkers to me. The response is, never saw that coming. And this is not false modesty. Like, I truly believe, like, this was like a little stopgap story. It was just like, oh, it's a girl and her dog in the apocalypse. And I never in a million years would believe that the response, or like, you know, the fact that, like, you know, Legendary showed interest, and, you know, we've been optioned by Legendary, and just that this would reach so many people. And I'm really surprised and very sincerely humbled. I know that word gets tossed around a lot, but I just, you know, I work in my pajamas in my bedroom. I'm not really on social media, so I have no idea until I get to conventions what kind of response folk have had.
Yeah, and have you had people come up and where they've just said, you know, when I was little, you know, I had a dog, or I totally see myself in Jesse, or Sandor's just like my dog. Yes. I mean, have you had those those interactions?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and then just, you know, and the love and the connection, that's so transcendent. I mean, just that, you know, this part of this massive legacy going on hundreds of thousands of years, you know, of human beings growing and changing, and then finally growing up enough that they can hold things not like themselves in their hearts. You know, that idea of, like, you know, domestication, you know, 10,000 years ago, and the first time forming this connection with something not like you.
Yeah, and Jessie's such an interesting character. You know, she starts off and we get this window into this child who maybe has had a little bit of a sheltered life. Her parents seemed, you know, in the early issues seemed very, maybe even overprotective. But she does start to, you know, evolve and learn and grow herself as, you know, as the series goes on. But yeah. I wonder, both as a character and a tool to explore this crazy idea and the themes that you've had, how do you see Jessie, and how do you relate to her personally?
Oh, goodness. I mean, it's a very careful balance, because Jessie, you know, Sandor and Jessie really are dual protagonists. You know, like, we start much closer to Sandor than we do to Jessie. You know, Jessie's a child, and we, you know, we have trouble sort of returning to that second childhood. And, you know, but we have this, you know, this understanding of Sandor and his mission and his desire to protect her. But she begins to grow up. Like, that's something that her parents couldn't prevent, and that he can't prevent. And he wants to protect her so much, but she is entitled to her adulthood. Like, it's the entire concept is that he's trying to protect her so that she can grow up. Is that this is a desired thing. This is a good thing. And, but it's, how do you help her grow up? You know, as the world's coming down in shambles, how can you be a good father? You were never meant to be a father. You're a dog. This is against everything. And every law of nature, every law of humanity. And, but he's trying his best. Even if he knows that he's going to do damage, is that, like, he's still trying, you know, there's the letter from, what is it, Sullivan Ballou, you know, to watch our sons grow up to honorable manhood. And that's what he wants for Jessie. But it's the negotiation between, that I'm sure every parent goes through, between overprotection and letting your children, you know, discover who they're meant to be. And she trusts him so much. You know, there's an arc where we have, it's called The Dragon, and there's this malevolent superstructure that's the site of horror. And Jessie is wound up in this place, and Sandor is trying to get her out of it in the aftermath of what they do. And he's just telling her, don't look left, don't look right, just look at me, just listen to my voice, just come through this, just look at me, trying to protect her even from the things all around her. And in the arc that we're just now finishing, Jessie is without his protection. And Jessie is confronted with some terrible things that he can't protect her from. And he's not there to say, don't look left, don't look right. He's not there to be the person leading her out. She has to get out by herself. And it's how that it's you can't say that it's good or bad because it's so complicated, that this is the act of growing up, is that the protections are gone, that it's you have to make the decision. And so, you know, in some ways it you know, when I tell people about it, it's, you know, it's an apocalypse story and it's a coming of age story. It's a road trip story. And that the coming of age, you know, there's a level for the Sandor's arc is his understanding that, you know, a ship can be safe at harbor, but it's not what ships are meant for. And that, you know, you can keep this child safe, but she won't be a child forever. And that you will begin to deprive her of something that is her right. And, you know, so there's a lot of, like, I see myself more in Sandor than I do in Jesse, but, you know, there is a level that, you know, every child who has grown up, you know, remembers that. And that moment of struggling, you know, for your own identity and your own freedom. And I think we do a disservice when, as adults, we can't go back and remember how it felt to be children and offer the same compassion to the, you know, the kids who grew up after us.
Yeah, and it's, again, just a way to make the story so relatable and what makes it so interesting, because you can, like, if you sit here just as an exercise and you know, read the stories and replace Sandor in your mind with a human father, right? Mm-hmm. The story's the same, the struggles are the same, the love is the same, and it's so interesting to see it through the eyes of you know, a being that's had different experiences growing up, and it's always that balance. And then the other balance you have to strike is, well, you're telling such a human story, right? You've got to make sure that you're hitting all the story beats and giving that enough kind of attention and spotlight. But then you've also got your big overall kind of mystery story, like, how did this happen and what are the ramifications of the fact that these animals have sentience? So that must be a tough balance to strike as well, right?
Yeah. No, and it's tricky. And, like, one of the things that I wanted to do was, you know, while we open up with sort of, you know, the big and more obvious elements, I did want to get into the things that we don't even think of. Like, I feel like in a lot of ways, our vision of the apocalypse is The Walking Dead. And, you know, a world that's greatly reduced in human population, you know, there's a force out there that is, you know, after you or could do you damage, and then it's sort of people fighting each other. And I wanted to get into just sort of, you know, the ways in which we've changed our world and the ways in which, like, how the world was before we existed. And so, like, we had this whole arc involving honeybees and bees and pollination, and how, you know, one of the things is that we sort of take for granted is, like, oh, well, you know, if we can't eat meat anymore, we can't hunt without it actually being, you know, killing a living, thinking being. There'll still be crops for us to harvest. But you need the bees to pollinate the crops for there to be any crops at all. And so everything is still linked and interconnected. You can't just cut off this one element or decide that, you know, you can do without this, or that you're going to, you know, you can't do away with it. You can't unhook yourself from this chain of creation. And so, you know, in, like, it's just revisiting places that are more obscure, you know, that are weirder, you know, or telling the story of this one old whale that's been around for hundreds of years, that remembered when men sailed in wooden ships. And came from a news article that I saw from a whale that had washed up, a whale carcass that had a harpoon in it from the early 1800s, and it lodged its jaw. And it was just, you know, and they're Greenland sharks that live for 400 years. There's a clam that's 500 years old in Mexico. And it's just, you know, this the animal world is so complex and so brilliant, and I think so unappreciated beyond, you know, commodity and exoticism. And I wanted to use animosity as a lens to sort of explore our debt to the natural world, in addition to telling this story about a father and his daughter.
Yeah, because the other piece of it is, like you were saying, you know, we can't eat meat anymore. We're reliant on to eat plants to survive. And in you know, as we are now, we're relying on bees to pollinate those plants. We haven't exactly been treating bees well, based on what we've seen happen in the you know, last few years. So who's to say if something like this would happen, I don't know that the bees would cooperate.
Yeah.
So it gets into really scary things when you think about it. So mm-hmm. being that there's so many ideas to explore and, you know, this whole animal world that I agree with you, we take for granted, what has been the most fun for you to explore in this crazy idea that you've created here?
Oh, goodness. You know, the craziest idea is one that I actually can't talk too much about yet because I'm still feeding pieces of it. And like there's a lot of weirdness going on in the background of animosity. It's, you know, things that people say that it should be impossible, or visions that they have that should be impossible. And so, like, those are the elements that will pay off ideally in the long run. And then I really enjoyed like playing with the dragon arc, you know, just in the, what was it? What else could have woken up? What else could have come back? And right. And so like the is there another level to this? And like, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, well, what caused the wake? And that, I gotta be honest, that question doesn't interest me. Like I have the answer. I may or may not decide to reveal it though in the fullness of time. Because I feel like that's not the point. It's like, you know, as a human being, it's like trying to call out of work being like, well, I don't know why I'm in the world. I don't know how humans gained intelligence. Why are we the only ones? Like, how did the universe begin? You're not allowed to call out from work with an existential crisis. And it's the same thing. Like, Sandor's got a mission to do. That's not the mission of his life. And I'm sure it's the mission of someone else's life is to discover why the wake happened. And someone else is trying to reverse. And someone else is trying to discover, you know, is there something else coming? But that's just not his job. And it doesn't really interest him that much.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question. Not that I would want to spoil, but yeah, I'm curious if you would ever let us know, you know, how it happened. Can things go mm-hmm. back to the way they were? And should they? Because, for me, I'm not really that interested in how it happened either, to be honest with you. I find it more interesting to think about, should things be ever put back? Because mm-hmm. now, these other beings, they're it's like these animals have souls. What right do we as humans have? Just because we happen to be the ones that had self-awareness first doesn't mean we're any better suited or any more deserving than these other animals, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's one of the things when folk ask me, because, like where did the idea come from? Talking animals have been around since humans, like, you know, just the idea of talking animals, because there is a discomfort in why are we the only ones who can do this? And so you have the idea of, you know, it was why I wanted to talk about religion very early on and spirituality and the soul and, like, you know, where do the animals fit in all this, depending on what you believe. And that, you know, you can explain it early on from, you know, well, man is created in the image of God. And so that's why you're the only one with this ability. But then, you know, even in the Bible, you know, you have the snake talking and all the Greek myths and legends, you know, animals are talking all the time, you know, Aesop's fables. I mean, just throughout all of human civilization, you have this sort of mirroring where humans imagine animals with the intelligence of humans. And sometimes it's to illustrate, you know, an object lesson, sometimes the fable, sometimes the creation myth. But there is sort of the discomfort, you know, even in children's movies, in Disney movies, you have, you know, there'll be an animal companion that talks, or there'll be a select few animals who talk. But it's even in those where they do talk, they're never in the same position as humans. Like, you know, Little Mermaid's very uncomfortable when you know, Ariel, who knows fish have feelings, is going to go marry a dude who's been eating fish his whole life. So there's a level at which once you allow that personhood that screws with our power structures on which all of our civilizations are built in a way that is very uncomfortable. And so even those stories where animals talk, and, you know, fables and even creation myths, there has to be a reason that, oh, well, but it can't be widespread. The animals, this one animal is special. It's a golden hind. It's, you know, it's a white doe. It's whatever. This one's special. All the others are okay to eat. In the same way that it's like, well, it's preordained. Like, you know, this clan or tribe or race is the ordained one. Everyone else is okay to exploit. And it's uncomfortable. You know, when you start talking about, you know, well, This is the food pyramid of the world. Why is it the way it is? How do we fix it? Because now you can't go back. Like you're in this apocalypse where it can't be put back in the box.
But again, it's the idea of story to to reflect and make us a little bit uncomfortable, make us reflect on who we are as a society and who we are as individuals and what can we do to make the world a better place. I mean, you look at the world you've created in animosity, like we were talking about. We take so much of the animal world for granted. We don't, respect nature. And if the story you're telling can even help one person kind of wake up to that idea, then I think it's definitely, beyond being a fun story to read and concepts of fatherhood and, parenthood and things like that. It's thinking about it as a reflection on nature and to make us more aware. I think there's a lot of worth there.
Sure.
Now, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But Hi. I did want to mention to our listeners something that I really feel strongly about is how this appeals to kind of younger readers, especially 10, 12-year-old boys and girls. And that's part of the reason I wanted to have Marguerite on as we're approaching the holidays, because I think it will make an excellent gift. And I'm actually going to be doing a giveaway. So pay attention to Twitter for the Hey. Rules on that. And we're going to give away a volume one of animosity that you can hopefully gift to one of your young readers. So my last question for you, Marguerite, did you always have that kind of as a target audience, kind of the younger readers, or do you feel it's just because Jesse's of that age? Like, how do you think that it resonates with young readers so well?
Well, actually it's the kind of thing that I would have devoured at 10 or 12, but now that I'm an adult, I know I just said, had this whole thing about being able to extend the same courtesy to younger readers now that we are adults, or to younger people now that we are adults. If y'all are parents or considering giving this to someone younger, I would recommend reading it first, because there is a lot of language and violence. And so it's the kind of thing that I would have like filched from a library and read secretly, but I cannot in good conscience fully endorse it for younger readers, just because it really is a rated M for mature title. And, that was one of the reasons that I was so hesitant ever to pitch it as an idea to anyone, because, people see talking animals and they assume it's for children, and it's really not for children. And, or people see, the level of violence, so that then turns off all animal lovers in the story. So I was like, so who is this book for? I have no idea. So I really do think that it has the most unlikely but universal appeal is what I have been proved, because originally I thought this story was going to be for me and no one else, and I've been proved wrong, for which I'm extremely grateful and extremely humbled, but which I'm still sort of grasping. But I really do believe that this is such a weird book, but has found a home in more readers than any other thing I have ever worked on.
It really seems to. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, go for it.
No, I was going to say, yeah, it really kind of transcends, and I didn't want or mean to imply that it was, only for younger readers, because I think the themes are universal and something we can all relate to. And it really does, as you said, kind of transcend any kind of demographic or target group. And there's just so many great ideas to explore. It's my favorite kind of comic story, one that makes you think, and that you find yourself thinking of, hours later, days later, weeks later, you're still chewing it, the ideas and the themes over in your head. And, comics are not cheap these days, so anything that, can last with you and add value, I think is really great.
Yeah. That's fair.
So is there anything else, as we close here, is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners? Anything you want to promote or have coming up?
Oh, for sure. So right now I'm on Power Rangers at Boom Studios. It's the other big project that I'm working on. And then we'll have a very exciting 2019 coming. And I'm not terribly active on social media, I admit. But if you were looking for me, I'm at Evil Marguerite, all one word, at Gmail, Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for your time. As always, Marguerite, it's great to chat with you. And if I don't talk to you before, have a great holiday. And I'm sure we'll run into each other at a con coming up in 2019.
Wonderful.